Welcome to this podcast. I'm Mark Burgess, Chairman of OMFIF in Asia, and today I've got a special guest with Steve Gilmore, who's the Chief Investment Officer of New Zealand Super. In fact, Steve and I are old colleagues at the Future Fund, the Australian Sovereign Wealth Fund. Steve's had a fantastic career. He's currently Chief Investment Officer for New Zealand Super, and I'll ask Stephen to go through and explain New Zealand Super in some detail. But prior to that, he was over 9 years at the Future Fund in Australia as Chief Strategist there and an extremely good investor. And he's also had terrific experience around the world at the IMF for a number of years, about 7 years, and also the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. So welcome to the podcast, Steve. It's great to have a conversation at this time.
Thanks very much, Mark, and good to be talking to you.
Yeah, I might just start off, Steve, if I could, just for those who are listening to the podcast who don't know New Zealand Super well, can you just give us a bit of a snapshot about the mandate, what the fund is, its size, and really, you know, what it's up to at a high level?
Sure. New Zealand Super is New Zealand's sovereign wealth fund. We have around $46 billion under management, and we were set up to basically be a pool of funds that would help the budget as the requirement to fund the universal pension system here became greater. So, you know, the sum of money will hopefully grow, and we will be drawn upon a little bit in the mid-2030s, but the big drawdowns will come around, you know, the middle of the 2050s. So it's a pot of money that will smooth the burden on the budget of paying out the universal pension in New Zealand. So we have a very long time horizon, given that the big drawdowns, our big distributions don't come until the mid-2050s.
We'll talk about your asset allocation in just a moment, Steve, but maybe just so that our listeners can understand it, could you give us a sense for how the asset allocation currently sits?
Probably the starting point is to think about our reference portfolio, which you can think of as being akin to an equilibrium portfolio or an expression of risk appetite. And given our very long horizon, we have quite a large exposure to growth assets or to equities in the reference portfolio. So to keep it simple, the reference portfolio has typically been an 80-20, 80 equities, you know, 20 bond portfolio. And that will give you an idea of what the actual portfolio is. Obviously, the actual portfolio will deviate from the reference portfolio. Our current, you know, actual portfolio has around 70% equities, a bit under 10% in bonds, has around or just a bit over 10% in a combination of real estate, infrastructure, and timber. And, you know, the rest, a decent part of the rest is in alternatives and private equity. But the, you know, the riskiness of the portfolio is not that different from an 80-20.
I'm just looking, though, at the funds, the way it's behaved in recent times. I know one of the great features of New Zealand Super is you have a long-term view. And so I don't want to turn this into a short-term discussion, but I also know from previous downturns in markets, you take learnings and you think about the way the fund's behaving during those periods. Can you give us a sense for how you've actually gone during this recent period of turmoil and any lessons that you've picked up along the way?
I think the starting point is that very long horizon. So we look to ride through those periods where there's market dislocation. So we're in it for the long term. And our approach didn't change through that period of sell-off and rebound. Of course, we supplement that, you know, longer-term, you know, reference portfolio view with more tactical activities. We have a very significant tilting program, which is a dynamic asset allocation program, which is systematic. And that program seeks to buy assets when they are relatively cheap and sell them when they're relatively expensive. So as the market was falling, we were leaning into the market. So we were buying equities on the way down, and we were taking greater exposure to credit. Perhaps the main way we would take advantage of or lean into the market sell-off was simply through that more systematic tilting program, which saw our equity position increase quite substantially, saw our credit position increase quite substantially, and we were also active in the currency markets. Supplementing that, we also saw opportunities in the credit markets and funding markets more generally. So we were quite active in that space as well. What I think was quite interesting about the market sell-off with COVID was that it happened very quickly. The pace of the decline was one of the steepest ever experienced. And the pace of the rebound was also incredibly quick. And if you're not primed to react quickly, in some ways you can kind of miss it. I think one of the other things that comes out of the shock, of course, is the liquidity impacts that occur. And in the case of countries like New Zealand and also Australia, when a large part of the portfolio is offshore, there's always a hedging question. And when you get a combination of asset markets falling and currencies falling, then there's a liquidity implication. So that was also on our minds, you know, given the pace of the adjustment. And of course, in our case, you know, we have, you know, ample liquidity, and that can be an advantage in sell-offs like the one we saw.
And we've obviously just launched our global public investor publication, and we look at global funds around the world of a whole range of varieties. But one of the most important things is the governance structure. And I think New Zealand Super has done this particularly well. A relatively small country, and you're taking a medium-term view, it'd be very tempting to become short-term in your focus, but you've got a governance structure that enables you to have that view. Maybe just very briefly just discuss some of the benefits of that, Steve.
I think the greatest benefit is being able to take the long-term view. A lot of people will say that they have a long horizon and that they're long-term investors, but quite often they get called out when there are market shocks. In the case of New Zealand Super, we've been pains to communicate to stakeholders just what might happen during periods of duress shock. For instance, a few years ago in our annual report, we explained what would happen if we went through another global financial crisis. And if we were to go through that sort of event again, we could expect to see a drawdown in the fund of around 50% or so. That's what you get when you've got an 80-20 portfolio. And of course, that created a few headlines, but then people recognize that it's a long-term, you know, proposition, and that if you take a reasonable amount of risk, then there will be, you know, large drawdowns from time to time. So people understand that. I think people also, especially internally and at the level of the board, understand how the dynamic asset allocation or tilting program works. And I think having that understanding really helps. One thing I found quite reinforcing, quite positive, was with Matt Winneray, who is the CEO, was on a radio program early on at probably the height of the drawdown in the markets. He'd explained how much the fund had lost, and people didn't really react at all. So I think it's become, I guess, reasonably well understood that there will be big variations in performance with respect to, you know, how the markets react. And having that understanding and having that support from stakeholders really makes it a lot easier to hold the line during those periods of distress. And that can be a huge advantage because it means, you know, we can be counter-cyclical. So when others are looking to sell assets, we can potentially be there, you know, to buy assets. And that's a big advantage.
Yeah, and I think, as you say, Steve, and New Zealand Super is known for this, you've spent a decade working on stakeholder management. As I sort of say to people, stakeholder management is an investment tool, an important investment tool, in fact, and New Zealand Super, I think, has done fabulous work there. Just moving to the current environment, you've come from policy, IMF, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, as well as being a long-term investor as well. We've seen an extraordinary intervention here by central banks, fiscal policy around the world, in response to this crisis. How are you interpreting that intervention and its impact on the markets?
I think it's fascinating, and I say that for a number of reasons. I think if someone had told you at the beginning of the year or even the end of last year that there was going to be a virus that was going to turn into a pandemic, it would have been quite hard to have foreseen just how people would react. It would have been hard to foresee how the markets reacted. It would have been hard to foresee how policymakers would react. So what we got was something quite dramatic in all three of those areas. I think for policymakers, at the level of the central bank, the central banks had learned quite a lot from the global financial crisis, so the toolkit was there, and they were able to move much more quickly and much more aggressively than was the case back in 2008, 2009. I think on the fiscal policy side, there was this pretty strong recognition that the scope for monetary policy intervention was much lower than it had been in the past, given that interest rates were so low. And also a recognition that governments were, in many cases, you know, seeking lockdown or imposing restrictions. And it was perhaps incumbent upon governments to step up and provide that financial support. So quite a change from the past when people were focusing very much on, you know, public debt. When you get this sort of shock, it focuses the mind and some of those debt levels become less of a concern. I think also in an environment where you've got low rates, and if real rates, you know, are sustainably lower or lower for a long period of time, those debt loads are somewhat more sustainable than might otherwise have been the case. So a very interesting period.
So one of the areas, Steve, has been, one of the focuses has been to drive interest rates down, effectively the cost of capital. And this has been a long-term 35-year trend of falling rates, but particularly now an intense period of possibly control of rates. People argue about that, whether rates are actually would be low either way. But how are you factoring that into the important issue of setting, for example, the cost of capital in valuing assets, in positioning the portfolio? Are you taking a lower for longer sustained, or do you think this is artificial, or is it somewhere in between? How do you think that through?
Well, Mark, you're right. There has been a fairly long-term trend in terms of rates coming down. Of course, there was a Bank of England paper showing that real rates have been declining for the last 800 years. Nearer term, we've seen a more dramatic decline from the early 80s, especially when the Fed and Paul Volcker stepped up to fight inflation. There has been that steady grind lower in real rates. I think, you know, many market participants, I would say most market participants, have underestimated just how low rates would stay following the financial crisis. And of course, you can look at what was priced in by the markets and what actually eventuated. And a fair amount of the, increase in asset valuations and returns has just come from rates being lower than might otherwise have been the case. We're like others. We overestimated where rates would be, and we've had to, you know, to think quite a lot about where those equilibrium or rates might be. And we do it from two perspectives. Obviously, when we're thinking about the reference portfolio, we're thinking about what longer term equilibrium might be. And here we could be thinking 30, 40 years. But of course, when we're looking at, you know, deploying capital on potential investments, we're looking at what the markets are pricing. So we have to take that into account from a much shorter term perspective. So, you know, the lower rates do feature. I think one of the other things from a portfolio perspective, if you get it wrong on rates, you'll not have the bond position you want, but you'll probably benefit from the equity position or the long duration assets. What's interesting now, of course, is that rates almost everywhere are so low that it's hard to see that you'll get the same sort of diversification from rates that you might have had otherwise. Of course, if policymakers were open to seeing rates go materially negative, that might be a little bit different in terms of a diversification effect. But you have the Fed and the RBA being somewhat averse to seeing, you know, rates go too much lower.
Which does bring us to the sort of portfolio construction question, doesn't it, in terms of positioning of the portfolio, getting that diversification, which I know you put a lot of weight on. And in fact, I know New Zealand Super take a total portfolio approach. So you think about it in the total fund and how all your positions add or subtract to the total risk of the fund. But could you tell us, has there been much change in your allocation to, say, real assets or unlisted assets? And how are you sort of coming to grips with the pricing and valuation issues as they currently stand?
I can't say there's been a huge change. In terms of pricing, this is always a tough one. And, you know, when you start looking at things on a standalone basis, they may look relatively expensive. But, of course, from our perspective, we need to think about it in terms of relative value as well. So if we're investing in real assets, we're effectively funding it from the reference portfolio. So our question is really, do we think the, you know, the underlying or the real asset will do better or worse than, you know, the funding sources? I think it'd be fair to say that we are relatively more interested in, you know, gaining exposure to real assets through time. But of course, they have to be reasonably priced. And it's possible that, you know, given the shock that we've had, that there will be more opportunities to acquire real assets at more attractive pricing. I think when you look at some of the assumptions that might have gone into earlier infrastructure investments, some of the assumptions that people would have made have been challenged. How many people might have anticipated that airports' cash flows might go to zero or close to zero? There are some social license, you know, questions that arise in the current environment we're in as well. I think in real estate, obviously some of the subsectors in real estate are more challenged than others. So if you're in retail, it's going to be less comfortable than would be the case if you were looking at things like logistics. So you get much more divergence between the different asset class subsectors. So for us, it is an interesting area for potential investment. But I can't say that we've made, you know, dramatic changes in the portfolio at this point.
It does sound, Steve, like, you know, we've had such a long period of falling interest rates that it's lifted the value of all assets in many ways. You know, I sort of joke that there's not an infrastructure manager who hasn't performed well, who doesn't think he's a good investor. But what you're saying looking forward is that there's going to be much more bottom-up, asset-by-asset, understanding these thematic marginal changes, the type of asset, and as you said, some of the core assumptions that are behind them.
Possibly. And the reason I say possibly is that I, you know, to your point, Mark, rates have declined through time, and that has been a factor that has helped lift the pricing of a whole range of things. The potential for further rate falls, you know, is somewhat less, but if you've got rates that are really low for a very long time and you've got access to financing, then that can also be, you know, asset supportive as well. I think one of the big questions for us is, you know, what happens to risk premium in this environment? You can look at, you know, the policy wherewithal, you can look at where rates are, and you might think there are asymmetric risks. At the same time, you can still generate reasonable risk premium, even though, or still get access to reasonable risk premium, even though risk-free rates are low. And it's not obvious to me that you necessarily get this large correction in, you know, possibly overvalued assets, particularly if rates stay close to zero for a very long period of time.
I think that's an excellent point, Steve, that as we've talked with public investors, there are those who look at lower for longer and say, do not be too concerned about valuations of risk assets at this point because of that relationship. And I guess it sounds like you're in the camp of, you know, perhaps bubbles or the notion of excessive overvaluation. You need to be careful calling for that because these level of rates, there are still, you know, areas to invest.
I think that's right. I think what we see ahead of us is perhaps a more uncertain distribution. I mean, of course, we'll always say that as investors. You know, it could be that the risk premia that are available look relatively more attractive in a world of very low rates, or it could be that the capacity of policymakers to support the economy and the market is lessened, you know, given, you know, the shocks that we've had. And you've got to trade off those things. Right now, we don't know how long it will be before there's, you know, an adequate response to, you know, to the pandemic in the sense of having vaccines or having immunity or finding other ways to deal with it. We don't know how behaviors will change. We don't know how long policymakers will support, you know, economic activity, how comfortable they will feel taking on additional debt. It's also uncertain as to how long it will take to get back to the levels of economic activity that were, you know, apparent at the end of 2019. A lot of uncertainties. And then, of course, we've got some of the structural changes that may or may not be taking place. People's attitudes are changing, maybe less inclined to do as much traveling. So obviously, airlines have suffered. Technology becomes relatively more important. And there are a whole lot of things like that, which, you know, we need to think about in terms of the investment thesis going forward. How many of these things are near term? How many of these things are structural changes? How many of these things are actually just an acceleration of the trends we were seeing before?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And one area that New Zealand as a country, and in fact New Zealand Super has also been very focused on, is climate, environmental, social governance policies, but particularly on the climate side. You've got a clear mandate there, don't you? And what's your sense for the way investors will focus on this? Our analysis suggests that investors are becoming, if anything, perhaps even more focused through this crisis, that it's becoming a lightning rod to continue investing with a climate lens, with an ESG lens. But how do you see it?
I think that's quite possible. I think, you know, one of the questions we had before this was that if there were to be an economic shock, would people focus less on these environmental concerns because it hits them in their pocket? And of course, you saw what happened in France with the attempt to apply an additional tax on fuel, leading to a popular backlash. So, at some point, people get concerned about the cost of addressing some of these environmental issues. On the other side, of course, when you've got, the shock that we have, and you've got governments looking for ways to spend money constructively or ways to facilitate, that spending of money, environmental considerations, should be to the fore, I think, in terms of the range of possible areas for government spending. I think, for me, it's hard to know what the net result is, from the shock. Certainly from our perspective, we have a climate change investment strategy. It's something we launched back in 2016. It has several components. We analyze what's going on. We engage with companies. We obviously do a lot of research. Probably the area where we've lagged somewhat is in the search for those investment opportunities. And I do think, that's another area where we will pay more attention in the future in terms of trying to find those investments which, make sense from a climate change perspective. Obviously, we do have exposures to things like wind farms and solar and a few others, but I think there will be more fruitful opportunities in those areas as time progresses.
In our launch of the Public Investor, we had a really terrific roundtable down here in Asia, and towards the end I asked about people's current risk positions, and it was quite interesting in terms of most people are a little cautious on risk. They were thinking late cycle coming into this and perhaps haven't put as much risk on as they'd like. I know you have a long-term view, but just in terms of your current positioning, Steve, are you kind of in the middle of your risk range, one side or the other? Where are you currently?
Yeah, Mark, when you mentioned late cycle, were we talking about late cycle back in 2013 or 14?
Well, here in Australia, we could talk late cycle for 25 years and it never came. There was a consensus of late cycle. Are you guys sort of longer risk, shorter risk, or how are you finding it just as we speak at the moment?
As I said before, we have added some risk exposure in the credit and funding markets. I wouldn't characterize us as having anything materially different from sort of average risk in your parlance.
So I just wanted to just talk about your investment team just to sort of finish up here, Steve. New Zealand's a terrific place, great people and great location. So your organization's kept your team located in Auckland. One of the things that we looked at in the publication this year was the location of sovereign funds, and clearly, people are expanding, opening offices. I know the Future Fund Australia remains in Australia. You remain in New Zealand. Has this COVID change, the inability to travel, some of those things, do you think that could change the way New Zealand Super thinks about its location of its stuff?
The discussion on location is an interesting one, isn't it? Because some of our peers do have multiple offices around the globe because they want to be close to the markets they're potentially investing in. But you've got to trade that off against the cultural considerations if you do have offices offshore. And likewise, I guess you need to think about where your comparative advantage may be. I'm not so sure that we as a fund have that many comparative advantages when we're competing in highly contestable, offshore markets. So it's not clear to me that we would gain those huge benefits. I think what we have seen, though, of course, with COVID and the lockdown and the inability to travel, is that people have become more imaginative in terms of getting things done. So more deals are done remotely. It's fascinating going through due diligence processes remotely, and it shows what can be done. I think one of the key things there, though, is that, you know, quite often relationships have been established previously. You've met people physically, so you know who you're dealing with, and it's okay completing those transactions remotely. It's more difficult, I think, when you don't know the people involved and all the connections are virtual. You know, I still think there's a huge need to have those personal relationships for trust, you know, for, you know, strengthening alignment and so on. But having said that, there's an awful lot of stuff that can be done online and remotely.
Well, that's terrific, Steve. I do have just one final question, which sort of wraps up the asset allocation thing. And you've alluded to this a couple of times. Yeah, you know, we all like to try and find diversifying assets, assets that will give the portfolio a smoothness, even a long-term portfolio, and still the rate of return, the combinations to get your risk-adjusted return as high as you can. Do you think with rates at these very low levels, with the behavior of markets, that it's just getting harder to get that diversification, or do you think you just have to work harder to find them?
My net take is it's harder to get that diversification. In our case, you know, when we've got approximately an 80-20 portfolio, it's not going to be that diversified anyway. So we're focusing on making that portfolio as efficient as we can, which is, I guess, the way we think about diversification, given the amount of risk we have. But of course, that becomes more and more difficult, given the valuations and given the potential or lesser potential for rates or for bonds to perform their traditional role in portfolios.
Well, that's fantastic, Steve. Thanks very much for your comments today. I know New Zealand Super does some fabulous work in making their stakeholders think about the long term, but really over many years, you've also done fabulous work in traveling the world and sharing your investment ideas, sharing your mistakes, your successes, being open to lifting the standards of all investors, all public investors globally. And it's a little harder to do now, perhaps has to be done virtually, but once again, Steve, by talking to us today, you've just reinforced that New Zealand Super is open for business and open to sharing your thinking. So we really, really appreciate that at OMFIF, and I'm sure you'd be open to talking to anybody to share ideas in the future. So thanks very much, Steve.
Of course, and thank you very much for taking time and for asking me to join the series, Mark.